This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, drowning spike while smuggling booms as EU-bound refugees and migrants are driven further underground. The payday loan industry in the U.S. may soon have to change its more predatory practices. And the most educated group of immigrants in the United States struggles with high rates of underemployment. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The June 1st deadline for the Syrian government to allow humanitarian aid to reach a list of besieged towns has come and gone. The World Food Program is now considering airdropping aid packages, and the UN Security Council met Friday on the issue. Thursday, UN Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Ramzi E. Ramzi, reiterated that land delivery is by far the best way to get the most aid to the most people, especially in urban areas.
Air delivery is certainly not a substitute for land delivery. Land delivery is more effective, more efficient, and less costly. Air delivery is complex and extremely expensive, but it remains an option if land deliveries do not go through.
It's unclear if any mechanisms exist to actually enforce the June 1st deadline, but it does apply a degree of international pressure on Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to stop foot dragging on aid deliveries. UN Senior Advisor Jan Egeland.
May was a very bad month for us as a humanitarian task force. We reached many fewer places and many fewer people than we did in March and April. June seems to become much better. Not only because we reached Daraya for the first time since 2012, since it was besieged with the first limited humanitarian installment, but also because we actually plan to go to 11 besieged areas in the next few days.
The UN and the Red Crescent struck a cautiously optimistic tone about the very limited aid that was delivered to Daraya. But nearly none of what did get through was the basic survival necessities that the people stranded there most need. No food, no water purifiers, and little medicine. As of Friday morning, there was still no set date for delivery of the balance of the aid. Syrian officials did enter the public statement fray Friday, saying the government would allow humanitarian aid to reach a limited number of areas, including almost a dozen that are besieged. But similar commitments have been made in the past without follow-through. The UN's Humanitarian Aid Task Force has a list of 19 locations in Syria it hopes to reach and says nearly 600,000 people are now stranded in besieged areas of the civil war-torn country. The war in Syria is but one of many factors pushing waves of refugees and migrants towards Europe, and the journey is now deadlier than ever. Hundreds are drowning off the coast of Italy on a weekly and even daily basis. Greek police are dismantling refugee settlements, and smuggling routes into Hungary are skyrocketing. Despite border closures and resettlement plans, Europe's refugee crisis hasn't gone away. If anything, it's become more complex and more diffuse. Andrew Connolly reports from Subotica, Serbia.
Thus far, 2016 is proving to be particularly deadly. Some 2,510 lives have been lost so far.
That was spokesman for the United Nations Refugee Agency, William Spindler, speaking on Tuesday from Geneva. Europe's Mediterranean Sea is a mass grave, and in the last 2 weeks, the International Organization for Migration estimates that more than 1,000 people have perished trying to reach Italy from North Africa. But who are they? A popular belief holds that the combination of border closures in Europe and the EU-Turkey deal has forced Middle Eastern refugees to take more dangerous routes from North Africa to Italy. But the statistics prove otherwise. According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, the top three nationalities crossing the Mediterranean from Libya are Nigerians, Somalis, and Gambians, not Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghans, who mainly use the route from Turkey to the Greek islands. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler again.
Whether they want to come for economic reasons to Europe or whether they are fleeing war and persecution, there is no other legal alternative open to them. People are desperate. They will take to sea whatever the risks. If we stop saving them, more people will die. That will be the only consequence.
Last week, Greek authorities cleared and shut down Europe's largest informal refugee settlements near Idomeni on the Greek-Macedonian border. What happened to Idomeni's former residents? That remains unclear, says Katie Anasuch of the medical NGO Médecins Sans Frontières, who was working at the camp.
When these people have been moved, some of them we know have been moved to camps that are unacceptably poor in terms of their conditions, in terms of the water and sanitation provision and the hygiene. And that in itself is incredibly unacceptable.
Half of the remaining 8,000 at Idomeni just spread out to improvise campsites on the forecourts of nearby gas stations and hotels. Those with some money left found a way to slip through the cracks of Europe's fortifications. Just because European leaders say that the Balkan route is closed does not make it so. 300 miles north of Idomeni, volunteers in the Serbian capital Belgrade are reporting between 1 and 200 new refugees arriving each day, their passage facilitated by human smugglers through either Macedonia or Bulgaria. From Belgrade, their journey continues north to the Hungarian border, where a small tent village has sprung up in the village of Kelebia, where Hungary permits a handful of families to enter each day, a process that may take weeks. Single men are far less likely to be accepted by Hungary, so the quicker and far more popular route for them is to hire a smuggler who, for around $150, will cut a hole somewhere along Hungary's 110-mile barbed wire fence at night. However, this is far from risk-free. A growing collection of testimonies by refugees allege abusive treatment by the Hungarian police. Ali is a 25-year-old dentist from Afghanistan who, hoping to reach his parents in Germany, had tried to enter Hungary with a smuggler. Ali claims he and his friends were assaulted and sprayed with chemicals by the Hungarian border guards, who then pushed them back to Serbia through the hole in which they entered.
It was very small hole, we couldn't see. They were pushing and kicking in the ass and hitting with the buttons.
The Hungarian police claim to have apprehended more than 12,000 refugees who breached the fence so far this year. Once detained, some are put on trial or in detention. The lucky ones are taken to open camps from where, under the turned heads of the authorities, they can continue their journey through to neighbouring Austria. In many ways, the Serbian-Hungarian border has become a metaphor for the EU's wider refugee policy failure. Faced with ever-diminishing safe and legal routes into Europe, the illegal and risky clandestine options, by land or by sea, seem like the only hope for most people, even as the casualties and deaths continue to rise. Andrew Connolly, FSRN, in Subotica, Serbia.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. On Thursday, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, released a proposal for the first ever federal regulations on the payday lending industry. The CFPB was set up in 2010 in the wake of the financial crisis as a watchdog agency for consumers in the U.S. FSRN's Robert Packard has more.
The payday loan industry in the United States may soon be changing thanks to new regulations proposed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the CFPB. The proposed regulations are, in the words of the CFPB, quote, aimed at ending payday debt traps. About 12 million U.S. residents take out payday loans and other similar short-term high-interest loans each year, frequently to cover daily living expenses. According to the Center for Responsible Lending, these so-called predatory loans can carry annual interest rates of 400% or higher. Consumer advocates criticize the industry for creating a cycle of debt, with borrowers often having to renew their loans for a fee or taking out a new one shortly after repaying the first. Morris Pearl is the chairperson of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of more than 200 U.S.-based millionaires who support legislation to lessen the country's income inequality. He says there is incentive for lenders to make loans they know can't be paid back.
What they do is they make loans with they have no expectation of ever being repaid, but they make a profit because they charge such high fees and interest rates on the loans, even though the person never actually finishes paying off the loan, it can still be a profitable loan for the lender.
The CFPB's proposal would, if enacted, require lenders to verify a customer's income and confirm they can repay the debt on time. It would also reduce the number of times a customer is allowed to roll an old loan into a new one or to take out consecutive loans. This is not the first time the CFPB has indicated its desire to regulate the payday loan industry, having announced it was considering potential proposals in 2015. The regulations could go into effect as soon as next year and would not require congressional or other approval, though a period for public comment on the rules will be open through September 14th. Robert Packard, FSRN, Charlottesville, Virginia.
The Migration Policy Institute counts Black immigrants as one of the fastest-growing demographics in the United States, increasing by almost 200% in the 1980s and 1990s, and doubling in size during the 2000s. Once in the U.S., these immigrants generally have higher rates of college graduation than their counterparts from other regions of the world and U.S. citizens alike. And FSRN's Lina Nozizwe reports, many African immigrants arrive with impressive levels of education.
Do you know who the most educated immigrants coming to the U.S., who they are?
I don't, but I'm willing to hazard a guess.
Hazard?
I would say it's probably South Koreans, Japanese, and Africans.
Akili has spent more than four decades as a racial and social justice advocate, and even he paused when guessing which immigrants arrive in the United States with the highest level of education. According to the Washington-based think tank, the Migration Policy Institute, immigrants from sub-Saharan Africa are among the best-educated immigrants entering the U.S.
I would say it is not a surprise.
That's Amira Woods, an associate fellow for the Institute of Policy Studies. She says it's not uncommon for highly educated Africans and West Indians to come to America and seek better lives for their children.
If you think about the level of the number of PhDs, clearly Nigerians top that list. You have also Eritreans, highly educated, that are coming to this country, and of course from the Caribbean. Some are coming as medical professionals. Some are coming as teachers that are bringing their gifts and talent.
But higher learning does not always translate to higher wages in the U.S. The Migration Policy Institute says well-educated African immigrants often earn substantially less than U.S.-born Americans with fewer years in school. Liberian-born Charlene McGee, a public health educator based in Oregon, says she's seen evidence of that firsthand.
I know a lot of people who are Liberians, actually Africans, who are very educated, with lots of lived experience, but have been unable to find employment. And as a result, they end up experiencing, you know, different forms of inequities and disparities because they unfortunately, in a lot of instances, have been forced to leave their home countries, you know, due to forced migration, and just have a difficult time here finding work to be able to provide adequately for their families.
She says she knows African immigrants who came to the U.S. as doctors and lawyers who have difficulty finding work. That includes McGee's own father, who came to the United States with one master's degree and earned another one here, but has been underemployed for decades. Randy Capps of the Migration Policy Institute says one problem that immigrants face is that degrees and credentials earned abroad are oftentimes not recognized within the U.S.
In the healthcare field, this is very common. Sometimes it means that they might have to go back to school for several years to get a degree at a U.S. institution.
And is it any more severe with the African educated population than other populations, immigrant populations?
Yeah, I don't think we have good data on that. We just know that underemployment tends to be a little bit higher, at least initially, among African immigrants than some other immigrant groups, like immigrants from Asia and Europe, don't have as high underemployment rates, at least initially. But those from African immigrants speak English, so it's probably not an English language barrier. It probably is much more related to where they got their degrees and the degree to which they're recognized in the U.S.
The cost of higher education in the United States to open the door to accreditation can also be prohibitive, and another reason for them to take jobs below their skill levels, just so they can survive. And while Liberian-born McGee says education is clearly not a panacea, it is a part of building a better future for Black immigrants.
Yes, there is high on and underemployment within our communities, but education is definitely the precursor to really changing the tide. Being educated in a profession allows you to sit at tables where oftentimes your voice is definitely needed, and if you're not at the table, you will be on the menu.
A lesson many immigrant Africans have already learned. Lena Nozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. The Gaza Strip has never been a major tourist destination, though before Israel clamped down on the coastal region's borders, visitors traveled there not only to the beach, but to explore the area's more than 30 ancient sites. Now, for almost a decade, tourism has been nearly non-existent, and archaeological work all but stopped. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Here at the Rafah Hilltop, the largest and most ancient of Gaza's archaeological sites, three workers use primitive tools to excavate ancient artifacts that can be traced back some 4,000 years. But ever since the Israeli siege of Gaza in 2007, these historical relics have been all abandoned by foreign delegations and international tourists. Assad Ashour is a leading Gaza-based historical researcher.
In the past, foreign archaeological expeditions interested in maintaining and excavating these sites, especially tourists and journalists from France, would come to Gaza. But Gaza is a small region, and with the ongoing instability here and the frequent wars, it can't be considered a tourist destination.
The region is home to dozens of significant archaeological sites, including the Bacha Palace, the Byzantine Church, and the Barkuk Castle. Ashour explains that throughout history, Gaza fell under various rules, including the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptian Mamluks, and the Ottomans, all left behind signs of their presence, from shards of pottery to ancient mosques. Many of the remaining historic structures reveal the ongoing instability and the frequent wars here. According to the Gaza-based tourism ministry, both the 700-year-old Bacha Palace and the 300-year-old Ottoman Mosque were damaged during the 2014 Israeli offensive in the region. Marwan Chahwan owns a private museum located in Khan Yunis, a city in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. There are no publicly operated museums in Gaza, and just a few that are privately owned, like Chahwan's. He describes some of the antiquities in his collection, including clay pots and swords dating back as far as 5,000 years.
I began collecting artifacts in a marketplace when I found an ancient clay-made water jug. Afterwards, when I traveled to Rafah City for work, I asked people about ancient items and collected all these things that you now see.
And much more is likely yet to be discovered in Gaza, remaining buried by both time and conflict. In early April, a construction crew breaking ground for a shopping center unearthed an ancient Byzantine church. Yet work on the shopping center continues, with no plans to pause for any further excavation. And even if there were, recovering and preserving newly discovered antiquities proves challenging. Hiyam Albitar is a senior staff member with the Tourism and Archaeology Ministry. She says the siege has largely stopped archaeological reconstruction and maintenance projects in Gaza.
We lack white cement and some of the chemicals used in brushing and cleaning metal items. Of course, the Israelis argue that such substances are dual use and could be used in activities other than antiquities maintenance. These include some alcohols like ethyl or C2H5. And we don't have the advanced equipment we need to locate antiquities within the various sites.
And with so few people coming to Gaza to either work on or visit these significant historical sites, the ripple effect is felt in the local economy as well. According to Gaza's tourism ministry, prior to the Israeli siege, the tourism sector contributed about 5% of the region's GDP. Now, because of current conditions, it's no more than 2%. In 2011, Palestine gained admittance to the UN's Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO. Efforts are underway to get significant Palestinian historical sites designated as UNESCO World Heritage Sites, but none of them are in Gaza. Back at the Rafah hilltop, limited excavations continue. But with most of Gaza's historical sites falling into disrepair through lack of a proper maintenance and physical stressors in repeated wars, perhaps those sites, still undiscovered, are safest left as is for now. Rami Almighari, Afas Aran, Gaza.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates about one-third of all food produced globally goes to waste, creating a massive amount of greenhouse gas emissions and needlessly squandering water, land, labor, and energy resources. This waste is drawing the attention of global agriculture organizations and financial institutions, which have started to back initiatives aimed at scaling back food waste. Now a group of farmers in Uganda have come up with one solution, transforming food into novel products with a longer shelf life. FSRN's Ngala Kilinchimton reports.
Elizabeth Nsimadala is a 36-year-old mother of two from a small village in southern Uganda. She is a founding member of a group of female farmers who have been making big returns by turning bananas into wine, a relatively novel product now adding diversity to Uganda's cuisine. But it was not always so. Before the year 2000, Nsimadala struggled to make ends meet in agriculture, frequently going hungry and repeatedly unable to pay school fees for her kids. Then an NGO came along, teaching farmers in her area about better ways of producing and managing banana yields. And while the methods did increase output, Nsimadala says it had unintended consequences.
The project, which was supposed to be a blessing to the communities, became a problem because there was overproduction, but the prices decreased. So, you know, instead of getting money from the bananas, a bunch went as low as 500 Uganda shillings. I don't know, this is something like a quarter of a dollar. So it went so low to that level. And, you know, people were instead chopping the bananas and giving them to animals. So they became of no use.
Her story is common across Africa, where harvested food crops are often lost because the cost of transporting them to markets is more expensive than letting them rot in place. Meanwhile, people who need food the most don't have money to buy it. Nana Osei-Bonsu, CEO of Private Enterprise Federation Ghana, says this aggravates food insecurity on the continent.
$4 billion US dollars equivalent of food losses in a year in the continent. And if you can conceptualize what $4 billion can do to alleviate poverty in our various countries, then you can understand the waste and the economic deprivation that food loss is causing the continent. Apart from food losses, there's a food waste, the two different things. The food waste is the cooked food that we don't use. And at the end of the day, they're not apportioned to people who need it. And we have about 800 million in the world going hungry every day. And we have excesses of food that are going to waste.
The causes of food loss and food waste in Africa are closely linked to lack of infrastructure, affordable transportation, and even harvesting techniques, says Nana Osei-Bonsu.
Let me give you an example. Tomatoes. People harvest them when they're red. when they're red and you pick them, they don't even last 36 hours. But if you pick them green, they give you 7 days or more. So there are a lot of factors that contribute to this magnitude of losses.
The inefficiency of moving food stocks to hungry mouths can be an even bigger problem in 50 years, when Africa's population is expected to double. Musa Sek is the chairman of the Pan-African Agribusiness and Agro-Industry Consortium.
If the world population doubles, what should be doubled then? It's not cars. It's not highways, but it's mostly food. But the problem is, mankind has made more than 10,000 years in order to come up today to 7 billion tons worth of food. 10,000 years of constant progress. And when the world population doubles in 50 years, we have to double these 7 billion tons.
African countries, through the Comprehensive Africa Agriculture Development Program, say they are committed to eliminating hunger and cutting extreme poverty in half by 2025. How this will be achieved, according to SEC, is not only through production, but more importantly, by avoiding the loss and waste of food already produced. Elizabeth Nsimadala and other farming women in Uganda could offer significant lessons in this regard. The bananas that used to be thrown away are now fetching them significant returns on their investment, thanks to value addition. In other words, processing the crop into another more novel product with a longer shelf life.
We were trained in banana wine production. We started the production on a small scale, but like for a new innovation that comes, it takes some time for people to embrace it. But later on, our mindset kept on changing. I do a comparison between the prices. It's actually more than 100%. For example, a bunch that can go for $10, once processed, you can be able to make a net profit of $200, which is unbelievable to many, but to me it's a reality because I'm doing it, we are doing it, and we are getting the results.
Nsimadala's success has been hailed as a best practice by the African Union, but continues to be an exception to the rule. In the short term, however, Bonseri recommends that African governments set up agencies to buy and store food in peak season for eventual redistribution during lean periods. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Accra, Ghana.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find podcast info and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Sonic Mystery via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.